Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm delighted to have with me today in the studio for University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Dalila Honorato. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Honorato was born in Portugal, where she graduated in Communication and Media Studies. In 1997, she moved to Greece, where she obtained her MA and PhD degrees at the University of Athens as a scholarship holder. Since 2005, she has been teaching courses on media aesthetics and semiotics at the Department of Audio and Visual Arts of the Ionian University in Corfu, currently as an assistant professor. One of the founding members of the Interactive Arts Lab, her research focuses on embodiment in the intersection of performing arts and new media, about which I hope we shall have a chance to speak. Her publications include The Symbolic Aesthetics of Shadow Play or The Perseverance of Puppet Theatre in the Digital Age and Bullfight, Embracing the Animal, Performing the God. At the beginning of 2014, she was a visiting fellow at the Centre of Philosophy of Sciences of the University of Lisbon. And since 2013, she participates in a research programme by COST, Appearance Matters, Tackling the Physical and Psychological Consequences of Dissatisfaction with Appearance. That's running until 2017. She's here in Malta on her sabbatical. She's chosen Malta for her sabbatical and is co-coordinating here the Media and Appearance Task Group of the COST Action Appearance Matters, which covers cultural, social and educational fields as well, and I'm sure she'll tell us something about that. Welcome to the programme, Professor Honorato.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to start off with a quotation from one of your papers, which I think sums up, shall we say, a little bit what your research does, and then I'll sort of leave it on one side and return to it. You say, "Signs are never innocent of meaning, sometimes universally clear, others having a restricted local meaning. Their heterogeneity defining cultural differences, while globalization homogenizes any symbol in a unique worldwide meaning." And that's from Consequences of Overexposure to Billboards and Cultural Jamming, one of your papers. Although semiotics is not your only area of study, it does seem to form the basis of much of what you research and teach. So I would like to start off with perhaps a dictionary definition of semiotics, which might be the study of signs and symbols and their use or interpretation. However, that definition seems a little barren, shall we say. In its simplest manifestation, I suppose semiotics is the study of how messages are emitted by objects through performance or through architecture and institutions. Perhaps you can elaborate a little on this fascinating field of semiotics.
Okay, I will try. Let me give you my personal interpretation of semiotics at least. So what it is, it's best to say what it's not, but okay. What it is to me, it's a method. It's not something that I might do exclusively. You don't have to be in academics to do that. I mean, everybody is a semiotician. The only thing is that some people prefer to use different tools to study signs. For example, while we are walking on a street, we can pay attention to different objects that we might find. So one thing that you have to consider, and this is something very good for a social scientist, because you know that the interpretation is always on the side of the subject. I mean, the object might have some characteristics. It has a shape. But the meaning of the object and the attribution of this meaning is something that, well, only the subject can consider. So, in order to do your semiotic analysis, some tools that are quite useful could be, well, let's say, cognitive psychology. Because, well, our tools of perception, let's say, our senses, they do not allow us to do or to see everything as we could see, as, well, there's so many senses that are not that much developed in the human species, in contrast with, well, some animals. Like, we don't see that well. And also our vision is not, well, it's quite limited to, what, 180 degrees? So we don't see our face, we don't see what is happening behind us. We don't see our full body, except if we use some instruments like a mirror. So taking in consideration that we see pieces of things, because movement is also a very important issue. It's not, the object is not static, it's moving many times, although we might not see it. And what else it could be useful for our analysis? Well, some knowledge of ethnographics, it can be also interesting, like knowing the how things have developed. Well, that the object, according to its contents, might have a different meaning. A little bit of psychoanalysis also helps. So that's it.
Well, certainly, I think that as we walk down that street that you mentioned and we look at the various signs, but in a wide sense of the word sign, we interpret them, as you say, as we go along, as subjects. If a Martian were suddenly to be plummeted down into that same street, he or she or it would not have the same reference that we have, so would not interpret that street and its signs in the same way. So I suppose we look at these signs knowing, coming from a social cognitive background that allows us to make those certain interpretations. And in fact, when we go and find ourselves elsewhere, sometimes we find that difficult.
Yes, well, there is some sort of universal understanding of things sometimes, like, well, I suppose what it means to be, to have a mother. I mean, this sort of, it's a more of a Jung approach that we all attribute certain values to, let's say, the same object or the same idea. But of course it's because those things, they are not, well, we are not aware all the time of that meaning that is so unique to the human species. The Martian is a good idea. Well, sometimes we ourselves, we are, well, let's say aliens in the different environment. Well, 2 months ago I was traveling, well, across the Atlantic, and I had a lot of fun reading signs. I mean, written signs, which are pretty obvious, but they use language in a different way. Or we use language in a different way.
Yes, that's very, very important to say, isn't it?
I do enjoy reading signs such as "Do not cross the yellow line" when there's a yellow line on the floor, which it's pretty obvious, but it says a lot about the way a culture works and understands reality, that you have to make things more clear or state things more firmly. I suppose that in the areas of the Mediterranean, you don't even have enough traffic signs to know where you're going. So that says a lot again about the way, well, not only about politics and our social organization of things, but about, I don't know, guessing or interpreting things using magic resources, like semiotics of, I don't know, reading tea leaves or something like that.
Somehow we get by.
Yes, somehow we find our way.
Last week you gave a very interesting talk under the auspices of the Department of Gender Studies within the Faculty of Social Wellbeing, and it concerned doors. And it was a talk about the semiotics of doors, which might seem such a very obvious subject, but in actual fact, one learnt as one listened to you that, of course, doors have different meanings, even though that a door is, as we discussed on that occasion, quite a universally understood object.
still it's used in so many different ways, and it's a social, a physical construct, but also a social one as well. Tell us a little bit about doors.
Entering doors. Yeah. Well, it's the semiotics of space, which is something that I'm very interested in. I like to think that it is in the context of aesthetics of everyday life. So trying to focus on certain objects that are quite obvious, as you said, but they have different layers. It's like peeling an onion. You always find more and more under it. Well, and eventually you will cry, because sometimes it's not that easy to go through it. So doors. Well, I could talk about, I don't know, ceilings and windows and whatever. It's true that there are too many objects in our everyday life that are interesting to focus, because we are, I don't know, our attention is quite carried away by insignificant things. We pay too much attention to the screen, and maybe we see more doors on the screen than actually in our... We touch so many objects, we touch so many doors, we open them, we enter, we pass through them, and we do not do that in a very aware way, a conscious way. So my effort was more or less to focus on this part, pay attention while you're walking. You're not doing something that is, you know, it's not an accident. You're there for a certain reason. You're doing a certain movement. Doors might be, I don't know, heavy, light. They're built of so many materials, and they open towards so many different things.
A lot of thought has gone behind the creation of each door, what kind of colour it is, what kind of handle is used, how easy it is to open. And as you say, so we take these things for granted, don't we, really? What I find interesting about semiotic approach or this method is that you look at something which you take for granted and deconstruct it in a way and try and look behind it, pun intended in this case, to see what actually created it. The mentality, the social context, etc. I mean, I find that really interesting.
Or what keeps changing it, because a door is not kept in its original way. We have, especially in Malta, we have so many doors, old doors. And sometimes it's interesting the way we recycle materials. And sometimes it's really... Well, the result is pretty bad, but other times it's quite fun and it's interesting. So it's also to understand who lives there, who uses those doors, because it's not just it does not only protect you from the eyes of the passengers, or it's not just to have your name on the door, or
it's part of the narrative.
Yes.
Let's pass on to a subject which I know that you like very much, and that's monsters. I'm quoting from your paper, Big, Bad and Ugly, The Concept of the Monster in Western Culture. And you say, Aristotle emphasizes, in his Politics, it is man's social character that defines him as a human being, otherwise an individual who by his own choice lives outside a group must be a god or a beast. I read this paper with great interest as it followed the development of the monster in its different manifestations and meanings. Monsters obviously interest you greatly. What is so fascinating about them for you?
Okay. And that's the story of my life. It's
how profound.
Yes. Well, that could be an answer, right? And that's my personal fascination. It depends on what we're talking about, what we define as a monster. They do not scare me that much. I mean, I think what we call normal people scare me more, because monsters are pretty obvious. They look different. They behave differently. And they are an extreme in the immense range of human or unhuman behavior that you might find. And they also explain the evolution of human society, because we have been attributing the word to different types of monsters. I mean, well, ancient Greeks would call the monster to something that is in between human and animal, because that was their fear. To be barbarians, to be, well, not civilized.
Not Greek.
Well, at least, yes. It was not that nationalist, actually.
No, not Athenian, or yes. Not Spartan, nor, I suppose one should say that.
Yes, not well-educated. They were afraid of becoming what they knew was the origin, which was the animal. So you find all their mythologies and their monsters, they're all half something. Because they're not that scaring if they just have an animal shape. They're more scaring because they're in between. And this thing continues through, well, medieval times. You could say that it's pretty bad to become an animal, to be transformed into an animal. And that was a punishment that, well, there you have the fairy tales, that you usually find in narratives that will say that someone was not morally correct or did a mistake, and that person was transformed into a frog or a pretty ugly monster. And
Sometimes they got kissed by the princess.
That's the good part about the fairy tale, that you have the opportunity to recover from that state once your ethics improves. Because it's just a physical aspect, the monster during this period of the fairy tale. You just look bad. I mean, you are bad, you might look good. So then you just are very unlucky and you will find a witch that will, well, change your shape and make you look like the person you actually are inside. So you just change your outside, and it matches your inside. And through that, the image that you're actually exteriorizing, you have the opportunity to improve yourself. It's like doing, I don't know, psychoanalysis for years.
Even the witch was a monster in a way.
Yes, but it was more like a medium. The sorcerer, it's something that helps the balance. Well, during ancient Greek times, you could find the gods, or the goddesses. They would help in this change. Well, so many nice ladies were transformed into animals because, there's also the erotic involved, which is not well understood here, but yes, you misbehave, and so you have to change your shape. Today we have different sorts of monsters. You refer before, aliens. So they're pretty frightening. But we also have robots, and which are more scaring when they are androids. I mean, they look like humans. Again, we have the same story as in ancient Greek times. It's what is scaring to us right now is becoming the machine and losing whatever it is that makes us unique.
Make us human.
Yeah.
There's also, connected with this idea of the monster in some way, the idea of the mirror, which you mentioned briefly earlier on. Another quote, the famous one that everybody knows, "Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest of them all?" You've written about mirrors in a paper entitled "The Mirror and Other Reflective Surfaces." And I'll quote again, "The level of self-consciousness cannot be reached through the reflection because it is a judgment based on two-dimensional image. And while one looks at the mirror, one cannot look inwards. The mirror is an obstacle to the development of critical thought. It fascinates with its mystery, but the idea of it being two-dimensional was really fascinating, that idea that because it's two-dimensional, you can't sort of look beyond. Tell me about that, because I was really interested in that idea.
The idea of the mirror as a barrier, an obstacle for self-reflection. The idea of actually see the mirror or the image reflected as any other image that you might find in your everyday life, like, publicity, an outdoor, for example, an image in a magazine that looks, so good. And all these stereotypes of beauty and the way you should be and the way you should move. So if we imagine, for an instance, that what we are seeing through the mirror is not exactly ourselves, because this idea of what we are seeing there is me, it's a pretty advanced idea and knowledge. Human beings and gorillas know what they are seeing. I mean, check a cat or a very small baby, they will not know. They will have to go through and past the age of 2 or 3 to understand what they're seeing, that it's there, it's them.
I've often seen kittens looking at mirrors and going behind to see where the other cat is.
Yes, or babies laughing at themselves in the mirror. That's interesting. So we are not always aware of what we're doing, so by seeing our reflection, we might fall very easily into the temptation of just interpreting that image and compare it with the stereotypes being projected through other two-dimensional media.
And that leads us into the cost action which you're involved in, which is entitled Appearance Matters, because we very often look at these images, especially young women who tend to look at these images and think that really that should be a reflection of themselves, but it isn't, and why isn't it? I suppose this is what you're sort of looking into in that in that action.
Well, to be fair to the mirror is also used as a medium for therapy, but you have to use your projection in a more, you have to be aware that it's you there, and you have to exercise yourself and to try to improve the belief you have in your own person. So there are many exercises that you can do in front of the mirror in order to believe in your capabilities. So the mirror is not just a bad thing, but it has been, in psychology, seen as a very important way of, self-recognition.
I was fascinated by your story, your personal story in that paper, where you said you'd had a mirror at the end of the corridor, and you never really liked walking back down the corridor because you were sort of imagining the reflection of your back in the mirror, but you couldn't see it. So you found that a bit unnerving.
It's always awkward, I think, not only to me, but to everybody.
Quite so.
It has to do with the symbolic dimension of the mirror. Borges, for example, in literature, the mirror is a gate to another dimension. So if you see mirror as a gate to another dimension, check Alice. Then it's scary. And you never know if it's moving in the same way that you do. It's going the same way or not. Do I have a reflection or not?
It's always back to front anyway.
Yes. As I said, our vision, our perception, it's really limited.
Well, we're almost to the end. 2 minutes. There is one more thing that I would like to discuss with you in the short time we have. Part of your work is to look into new media. And although we could have another program just simply on new media, perhaps you could just give a definition of new media and where your research interests lie.
The definition of new media is, it's simple. Any media that uses computer. We are not talking only about internet, we're talking about any sort of interaction. So there's interaction on the screen, there's interaction also, let's call it two-dimensional, but there's also three-dimensional interaction through the use of space, like, for example, an interactive installation. So the use of new media, what is new media, we have said, and the how can you match performing arts and new media? It's new media have been more used like an instrument, actually, a platform to support performing arts. You might have, well, think of the opera, which is, it has so many things involved. It's an art that uses so many different arts, theater, music, so on, dance sometimes. So new media might contribute to, well, the scenics, for example. You might have different, you might have a different environment, a different background for what is happening on stage, and this background can react to the action. So it's not actually a passive object, but it is an object that interacts with action. This might be coordinated through timing, but other times there's a sort of a dialogue, and you can have improvisation and new media involved.
Well, we shall definitely have to have another program about that. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you very, very much, Professor Dalila Honorato from the Ionian University in Corfu, for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.